When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
The Past, available on demand now, tells the story of a wife trying to get a divorce from her Iranian husband in order to begin a new relationship. In Stage Fright, a masked killer terrorizes campers at a musical theater camp. It premieres on demand on April 3rd.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on cable. The Art House is now in your house.
From New York City, this is Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit. I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. And on the new episode of SVU, I chase Matt around his apartment, and then he stabs me in the neck with a shot of insulin. Just the usual process.
You had it coming!
As we review David Fincher's Panic Room.
Later in the show, we'll bring you Cue Shots, where we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered around a common theme. And inspired by Panic Room, Allison and I were going to do a show about Kristen Stewart, who co-stars in Panic Room. And by about Kristen Stewart, I mean the Twilight franchise. And by do a show, I mean I was going to read my Twilight fan fiction series called In the Gloaming, which is about an incredibly charismatic and absurdly handsome film critic named Matt Stryker, who moves to the Pacific Northwest and comes between Bella and Edward. It's a powerful story, Allison, all 16 volumes of it. But then I realized, you know, if I read my world-changing saga on the podcast, I'm literally giving away tens of millions of dollars in sales and royalties. So I'm going to keep that, you know, we'll give a link
it's
at the
wise.
End of the show. If people want to, you know, like download it for their Kindle or whatever, we'll give out the link at the end of the show. But in the meantime, we're going to recommend some claustrophobic movies you can rent or stream at home right now. But first up is Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand. Allison, what are our picks this week?
Well, my first pick is Mistaken for Strangers, which is available on demand on March 28th. It is a film about the band The National, but it's not a concert doc or just one of those documentaries that's for fans, pre-established fans of the band. It's directed by Tom Berninger, who is the brother of Matt Berninger, who is the lead singer of the band. The band actually happens to be made up of two other pairs of brothers. There's one pair on guitar and keyboard and one pair on bass and drums. And Matt Berninger is this kind of tall, brooding, indie rock prince type who is married and lives in Brooklyn, whereas his brother Tom is this vaguely Jack Black-esque aspiring filmmaker who loves metal and still lives at home with their mother in the Midwest.
Weird.
Yes, and they're not that close as siblings. There's a 9-year difference between them, that Tom, the director, is the younger brother. And the film is about how Matt invites Tom along to both serve as a roadie on an international tour so they can spend some time together, and Tom wants to shoot a documentary while he's there. And it quickly becomes apparent that Tom is just inept at both being a roadie and at being a documentary filmmaker. The film starts off with him attempting to, and basically failing to interview his brother in the park. Like, he just does not know how to do an interview, and asks questions, not bad questions actually, of the band, of things like, do you carry your wallets with you when you're on stage? What do you, valid question,
totally
really.
Fair question.
Totally
I'd
fair.
Like to know that, actually.
Rockstar question. Yeah, exactly. And where does your wallet go if you're not, is it not
right,
in your
you
pocket?
Just leave it somewhere.
I
someone
know.
Will take it.
Exactly.
But yeah, it could throw you off when you're jamming.
Seriously. You don't want your wallet just
weight
hanging out there.
Weight distribution would just be all off.
So, pressing question that he asks.
How famous do you think you are?
You are way more famous than any of my friends.
That's okay. I would.
Have you ever heard of The National? They're from here.
I'm his brother, and I'm supposed to go on their tour bus.
This is one of the most talked about bands on the planet.
I think I'm going to get together with them. I'm going to be making this rock doc.
I do have a brother, but he's more of a metalhead. I think he thinks indie rock's pretentious bullshit.
2 weeks ago, Matt called. He asked if I wanted to go on tour and be a roadie.
I had no idea he'd never been to Europe.
Welcome to Paris.
Ooh, this doesn't even look like my arm. It looks like another person in the room when I do this. Who is that?
It's a really funny, kind of sad movie sometimes. Mm-hmm. There are a few moments where it feels a little stagey, but it is, for the most part, this kind of impressively interesting film about siblings and about how you can kind of have this very close tie to someone that you have very little in common with, and also about, you know, this, like, two brothers where one brother is the confident brother, the successful brother, in this case a rock star brother, and the other one is still trying to sort out his life. So it's really, it was like a very pleasant surprise. This film opened the Tribeca Film Festival a few years ago, and it was surprisingly offbeat, and it was one that really charmed me. So that's Mistaken for Strangers. It is available on demand on March 28th. My other two picks I have not seen yet, but I've heard a lot about, and they're both kind of interesting twists on established genres. The first one is Afflicted, which is available on demand on April 4th. This is a Canadian found footage film, and you know that you have to do a lot if you're getting acclaim in that genre these days.
In the Canadian found footage genre?
Yeah, exactly. Or in the found footage
Think I've
genre.
Seen it before, eh?
But
you mean more general found footage?
General,
okay,
yes.
Sorry,
it's a genre that's gotten a little abused lately, gotten a little overused. But this is a film written and directed by Derek Lee and Cliff Prowse, who also star in the film, and it's about how they are traveling the world together, and then one of them, and they're documenting their trip, like I think online it's supposed to be, and one of them has a kind of weird encounter with a woman that he meets and starts showing signs of an affliction.
Oh.
Hence the title. But what really interests me about this, beyond just having heard that it's a kind of nice, interesting indie found footage film, is that people have been describing it as a kind of horror twist on Chronicle. Which, Chronicle is a film that we both liked a lot. Mm-hmm. And I think the idea that that is an interesting one to me. So that's Afflicted. It's available on April 4th. Also available on April 4th is Goodbye World, which is directed and co-written by Dennis Hennelly. It stars Adrian Grenier and Carrie Bichet as a married couple of neo-hippies who are kind of living off the grid.
I saw the trailer for
yeah,
this.
Yeah, with their daughter. And there's a cyber attack that takes down a lot of technology, a lot of civilization, basically. And when that happens, a group of their old college friends all come to stay with them to kind of retreat and to the safety of their off-the-grid house, their kind of idyllic, neo-hippie living. And so it's half like them fearing what's happening to the world, and then the half also them kind of hanging out together for the first time in a long time. And among those, Gabby Hoffman, who's been really on a hot streak lately with a lot of the TV work she's been doing, Mark Webber, Benjamin McKenzie, Caroline DeVernis. So it's an interesting group of actors. And I've heard it described as The Big Chill meets The End of the World, which is an interesting enough premise unto itself that I'm intrigued, certainly. So that's Goodbye World, and it is available on demand on April 4th.
All right, our subject for Q Shots on this episode of Film Spotting SBU is claustrophobia movies. And, I think actually I do want to say one thing very quickly right off the bat, which is there's a you know, another kind of subgenre that I think probably overlaps greatly with this subgenre, if it is a subgenre, and that's prison movies. Movies that take place in prison, which we've actually covered on a different episode of the show. So we're not going to have any of those as our recommendations. At that time, our streaming recommendations were Hunger, Brute Force, Bronson, and Escape from Alcatraz. And to varying degrees, I think you could probably make the case that all of those are claustrophobic movies. You're trapped in prison. It's a small, confined space. They lend themselves to, you know, that atmosphere. So if you're looking for more sort of on this topic, that's episode 40 of Film Spotting SVU. You can find that at filmspottingsvu.com, or it should still be on iTunes. But so we're going to talk about non-prison related claustrophobia movies. Allison, do you have anything you want to say in a general sense?
Yeah, I actually, one interesting thing that I found when I started looking into some of the films in this category was that there is some overlap with our topic last time, which is movies with characters with no names. Because one of the classic types of this movie is where a group of strangers is introduced and put in a kind of claustrophobic space and, you know, have to sort out something, some problem, or, you know, and from things like 12 Angry Men.
Which, I know, when we decided on this, I was like, all right, so what movies would be good? Oh, 12 Angry Men. And I was like, and then I realized last episode I recommended it. So get ready to hear it again, guys. I don't know that many movies.
Yeah. Or Fermat's Room, The Killing Room. There's like a few kind of...
Fermat's Room. I've seen that one too.
Yeah. And The Killing Room was just at Sundance a few years ago.
I don't know.
It was just another one of like people brought into the room.
People trapped in a room.
Yeah, exactly. And then...
Well, I mean, it's a classic Sundance, Tribeca, any independent... I mean, it's a classic trope because it's cheap.
You have limited resources.
Sure.
Right? And then you
one room, couple actors.
Right. A high concept... You know, of sorts.
You don't need a lot of props, locations, budget. Yeah,
right.
All those things sort themselves out.
Right. And then you have, you know, another type of what's become a, like a kind of, I don't know, growing or at least consistent subgenre here. The like very high concept person trapped in or group of people trapped in like a...
Not a couple of people, just one person.
One. I mean, you have a...
Buried. Phone booth.
Freezer. The recent freezer.
That was a guy trapped in a freezer?
Yeah, I think it was Dermot Mulroney trapped in a freezer.
Not Dylan McDermott.
No, I think it was Dermot Mulroney.
Okay.
But I won't swear by that. One of the two of them is trapped in a freezer.
It might have been Dylan McDermott.
It might.
I'll look it up. Keep going. I'll
Dermot,
take a look.
Dermot.
Dermot McDermott?
Yeah. Wrecked. Adrian Brody trapped in a car. You know? This is a...
I don't know that one either. I do remember it. Yes, I never saw it.
You know, and I'm sure there are more in this category.
Okay, I looked up Freezer. Now, all right, let's go. Your life is on the line here, Allison.
Uh-oh.
For the gun to your head, for $1 million that I'm not going to pay you, who was it? Was it Dermot Mulroney or Dylan McDermott?
Dylan McDermott.
Yes, you are correct.
God, I survived to live another day.
Dylan McDermott was in Freezer. And
can
there
you read
he is.
The description?
Yes. This plot synopsis just says, Robert is an ordinary man who is faced with extraordinary circumstances. He is locked in a meat freezer. There's more.
Okay.
By Russian thugs, there we go, who believe that he owes them $8 million. Robert, who is in every frame of the film, soon discovers that he is not alone in the freezer. Sam, a stranger, is also locked in with him, and it becomes a struggle to survive the cold and the forces that are against them. So it's like Saw meets Buried. Saw is another one, actually,
right.
I thought about recommending, because I actually liked the first Saw.
Yeah.
At a certain point, I think they became a bit much.
Yes.
And certainly less claustrophobic, because they were just getting more expansive and bizarre, and the mythology became incredibly dense. But that original movie is really two guys locked in a room, and it is an interesting, scary film. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first saw definitely would qualify.
And then also, you know, there are some war films or Das Boot, you know.
Das Boot would be
maybe
a classic one. Yeah.
Which is available on Netflix and Crackle.
Yes.
Or it's not available on streaming, unfortunately, or otherwise I'd recommend it. But Lebanon, the 2009 Israeli war film, takes place entirely in a tank and is really a great film. It's very strong. And...
Certainly lends itself to intense either thrillers or horror movies. I mean, I'm not particularly claustrophobic, so I think actually that almost enhances these movies, because if you're not scary, you can kind of enjoy them. Like, I imagine if someone was actually claustrophobic, they would not be able to sit through a movie like Buried or...
I'll have a touch of it every once in a while. And the film that really brought it for me that made me... Usually I just don't put myself in that situation on screen, but The Descent, in the early scenes of that, you know, which is, it's a film about a group of women who go caving, basically, and then encounter creatures. But the early scenes of it, in which they are basically just climbing through these very narrow spaces, like, that was enough to really get me a little.
Yeah, and I think that one's available on Hulu Plus if you've never seen The Descent. So yeah,
it's a good one. It's a very good movie.
Yeah, and another one, just one more to throw out there, The Human Centipede. Is on Netflix and Amazon.
Yeah, that is claustrophobic as well.
Well, I mean, like, it all takes place mostly at this one, like, house or this laboratory where this guy's doing these horrible things. But then also there's, like, a claustrophobia of proximity to people,
right,
too.
You literally cannot get away.
You can't get away from people, which I'm almost more afraid of than, you know, than, and I'm talking about the specific, you know, anatomical elements. Just the idea of being, like, stuck next to a person and not being able to get away from them. There's something about that I find more unsettling than a small confined space. Maybe that's just me. I don't know. But that's another good one. So there's a lot of them. We haven't even gotten to our picks yet, but let's do that now. Do you want to go first?
Sure. So my first pick is of that type of film, of the group
of the people who are so
strangers,
butt to mouth.
Yes, exactly. That, you know, fantastic subgenre.
There's a lot of them out there.
There's so many out there. People sewn together.
There's the people ant. There's the societal
just keep
worm.
This going. Yeah,
the societal
please.
Worm is a good one. I also like the societal worm 2 full sequence. That's
nice.
A good one.
Yeah. No, this is of that where the group of strangers is together in a room.
Oh,
and there's
gotcha.
Some kind of problem for them to deal with. And this is a film called Exam, which is currently streaming on Netflix. It's a 2009 British film directed by Stuart Hazeldine, who co-wrote the screenplay with Simon Garrity. And it's set in this kind of alternate present, or it says soon, I think, is what they call it. But in which the world is dealing with this pandemic, and one company has managed to come up with supplements that keep it at bay. And this information emerges as we meet 8 candidates who are applying for a job that turns out to be at that corporation, and who are at the end of this unspecified but clearly very difficult application process. And the position is left vague, but it's apparently very desirable. So then you have this cross-section of 8 applicants who are brought into the room where the film mostly takes place.
Through these trials, you've gained some idea of the power of this organization. So believe me when I tell you that there is no law in this room, but our law. And the only rules in here are our rules. There is one question before you, and one answer is required. If you try to communicate with myself or the guard, you will be disqualified. If you spoil your paper, intentionally or accidentally, you will be disqualified. If you choose to leave this room for any reason, you will be disqualified. Any questions? Best of luck, ladies and gentlemen.
And they give each other nicknames, just like one of them gives them all nicknames based on, like, their appearance and race. So they get labeled black, brown, white, blonde, brunette, dark, and deaf for the one character who doesn't seem to play along. And they're all given a piece of paper and told that there's one question and they need to answer it. And they quickly discover all of the pieces of paper are apparently blank.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yes. And then it kind of builds from there, obviously.
Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah. I think, you know, I didn't think that this is the greatest film
dun,
in this
dun,
genre,
dun.
But I think it actually does what this requires really well, which is to have the build from there's a sense of normalcy to the inevitable escalation of things that happens in these. I think it does that very well. And the idea of it in a corporate sense of this being a job interview is a pretty interesting twist, I think, because it deals with a lot of ideas about when you don't really know what's expected of you, you know, in this application process, the lengths that people start to go to prove things that haven't necessarily been asked of them yet, you know, like this ideas about ruthlessness or these ideas about dedication that all come out as they go along, that, like, they think because this question is left so open and they're being observed, you know, they think prove that they might be a good candidate for a job that they don't really understand. So it's, you know, very clever. I don't think it quite sticks the landing, but I think it's a very good...
As someone who just got a new job, you related to this scenario very strongly.
Yes, exactly. Mm. It was exactly like...
The grueling. Is this how you got the new gig?
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Had to probably... I
there may
seen
have
the
been
movie,
some violence
so.
And... some dystopic...
They put a sheet of paper in front of you with no questions
exactly.
And told you to answer it.
And I'm like, I'm ready for this. but I think it's very kind of nicely efficient for what it does. And apparently this has been made into a play as well, which maybe tells you about that it manages that transition well, which is something admirable unto itself. So that's Exam. And it is currently streaming on Netflix.
All right. My first pick, kind of similar in terms of structure, the people stuck in one room. It's from 2010, and it's called Devil. It's streaming now on Netflix. It's directed by John Eric Dowdle. And there is, you know, you said of this subgenre of people stuck in a room altogether, maybe the, like, I don't think it's the first example, but one of the most classic examples is that famous Twilight Zone episode, Five Characters in Search of an Exit, where it's just five random people. They wake up in this kind of ill-defined room. They don't know how they got there. They don't know how they... You know, they don't have any memory of who they are. They can't figure out how to get out. And the whole episode is like their reaction to this very disturbing situation. And of course, it's the Twilight Zone, so there's a big twist at the end. And if you've never seen it, that episode is on Netflix. That's season 3, episode 14 of the original Twilight Zone. So if you've never seen that one, it's a classic one, which you can check out. Devil is kind of like a shadow remake of that episode. If that episode had been written by like Agatha Christie and William Peter Blatty, if they had been like decided to like team up. So it's like five seemingly random people walk into an office tower elevator and the elevator gets stuck and they're like trying to figure out a way out. But then what happens? Of course, that old chestnut, the lights go out. And when the lights come back on, Allison, one of them has been brutally murdered. But wait, there's a twist. Oh, by the way, the killer may not just be the killer. He may be... The Devil!
Steven!
Dun-dun-dun! Yes. There's a lot of dun-dun-duns on this episode.
Inspected and certified August 12th by G. Carson.
Hey, what do you say we go visit G. Carson when we're out of here? Tell him what we think of his inspecting prowess.
People, we're going to flip off the lights for one sec just to see if there's a short...
Wait, you're going to cut off the power?
Cool. Does that mean we could drop?
You'll be fine. I just didn't want you to...
What's happening?
Nothing. Just relax.
Hey, come on.
Get off me!
Sorry.
So if the fact that I've already described, I think, two or maybe three twists, and I haven't even gotten to, like, the rest of the twists, there's maybe three or five or 100 more, if that didn't give it away, this movie was co-produced and co-written by M. Night Shyamalan, and as is often the case in his career lately, I think his obsession with cleverness and surprising people is really his own worst enemy. The movie is good, and I think it would be better without the devil conceit. If it was just five people trapped in an elevator and every time the lights go out, someone dies, I think that's interesting enough. But this addition that it's all about, like, literally Satan is on the elevator or some kind of demon is on the elevator and there's supernatural occurrences happening all around it, it just adds some very silly moments. There's also, at the end, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a sort of, like, Signs-esque everything is connected kind of thing that happens, which is also just smack your head kind of silly. But beneath all the silliness is this very solid 80-minute B-thriller. You know, that the atmosphere on that elevator. Again, I'm not that claustrophobic, but that atmosphere on that elevator is fantastic. It's cramped, it's creepy, and every time the lights go out in the elevator, like, the whole screen goes black, and that's a fantastic trick. You know, it's an old one, but I love that thing where you're sitting in the dark. And, you know, so if you're watching this at home, definitely turn off all the lights, get that experience. And then, you know, because you hear the people screaming and there's, you know, all that is just a lot of fun. So I guess a little bit of credit has to go not just to M. Night Shyamalan, but to this guy, John Eric Dowdle, who directed this movie. The other thing he's directed that I guess he's sort of known for is he directed the American version of another excellent claustrophobic thriller, which is Wreck. Quarantine was the one he made, but Wreck is a fabulous horror movie, a found footage horror movie, not Canadian, but Spanish, and very claustrophobic, all takes place in this like one apartment building. And
really
that's
scary. I think
totally
we've talked
scary.
About it
I think we
before,
have too.
But yeah, it's so frightening.
Right. So credit to him for directing this movie, I think, very effectively in terms of all the suspense, the atmosphere. And there's a good performance, too, from Chris Messina, who's an actor I like. He plays a cop. He's outside. He's sort of like watching all of this unfold on a security camera, trying to figure out who the killer is from the outside while it's happening. So not a perfect movie. I don't love all the devil stuff, even though it is called Devil. That's a little problem. But a solid one of these claustrophobic thrillers. That's Devil, streaming now on Netflix.
All right. My next pick is of another, you know, we mentioned prison movies as this whole kind of obvious claustrophobic side genre. Mine is from another, you know, subgenre of this, which would be the airplane movie.
Ah, yes.
Because that's another
right.
one where
you can't get out.
You can't
trapped.
Get out. You're on this enclosed space and you're traveling. You know, you can't stop it. And
right.
unless you're willing to, you know, take a header.
Unless you're the pilot,
plane.
I guess. Yeah,
yeah. Or you're the pilot. Yeah. So my pick is Red Eye, which is available to rent on YouTube, iTunes, Amazon, and Redbox. 2005 film directed by Wes Craven and written by Carl Ellsworth. And I think it is really, I think it's kind of an underrated film. I know it was fairly well received when it came out, but this is a film I really like. And the bulk of it takes place on a red-eye flight to Miami, which is where Rachel McAdams' character, Lisa Reissert, works at a high-end hotel. She meets a charming man at the airport who's played by Cillian Murphy and who she should probably have been more cautious about in the beginning since his name is Jackson Ripner. But she flirts with him, and then he turns out to be sitting next to her on the plane, which is a pleasant surprise. And she's a little anxious about flying, so he's talking her through it, and then reveals himself to be a part of a terrorist group planning an assassination at the very hotel she works at, and with a hitman outside of her dad's, you know, where her dad lives, ready to kill her dad if she doesn't choose to cooperate.
Hi, that's actually my seat.
You're kidding. You're not kidding.
The name's Jackson.
Lisa. So what do you do?
As fate would have it, my business is all about you.
I'm not sure where you're going with this.
J.R. Joe Reissert. Your father?
Where did you get that?
Grabbed it off your dad's desk next to your graduation picture. You tell the flight attendant and your dad dies.
What can I do for you?
She's just had a really rough day. A death in the family.
And the film doesn't entirely take place on the plane, but most of it does. And really the most interesting part, which is this cat and mouse game between the two of them in which she keeps trying to signal people that she needs help, but secretly, so that he doesn't notice. But also, you're on an airplane sitting next
right.
to someone. There are
kind
only
of
so many
room-ish in
exactly,
that way.
And it does, and not just in that way, but also in the way that it's very much about a female protagonist.
Right, there's a gender element.
Yeah, there's a gender element, and I think I really like not just that the film starts off with this kind of romantic comedy air to it, that it then turns into
right.
something like much the sinister thriller. But I really like, the two of them are really good, as much as I think that Cillian Murphy is maybe not the most physically imposing guy to, like, threaten someone, to kind of intimidate someone in that way. But they're really good together, the two of them. And Rachel McAdams in particular kind of channels this whole storyline in which her character was assaulted and raped 2 years before and kind of talks about it, and it has this extra layer of vulnerability in that. And the film kind of turns on this moment in which she says, she's telling the story to him, and he says, oh, so you learned, you know, it's not your fault. You have no control. And she says, no, what she learned is never would let it happen again. And I think yes, exactly. And I think that's, there's something really kind of nice about that moment, and given how it plays off of her, this kind of vulnerability that she has, that she's been trying to get over. So it's an unusually smart film. It kind of goes into more traditional territory at the end, but it's got a great pair of lead performances with those two actors, and they're kind of nicely unconventional, which is something I really like. So that is Red Eye, and it is available from rent on a lot of the usual suspects.
That's a good pick. And you had a airplane movie, a means of conveyance, being trapped in one, and mine is somewhat similar, a different transportation mode, though, not a plane, but a boat, a life boat, if you will. I'm picking the movie Lifeboat, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, and it's available to purchase on Amazon and available to rent on iTunes. And Hitchcock, of course, made several claustrophobic thrillers that were set in one location. There's Rope, which was set in an apartment during a dinner party. Rear Window, another apartment set movie. Lifeboat, though, takes place on a lifeboat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. The movie is set during World War II. There's a battle at sea between this Allied freighter and a German submarine, and both ships sink. And then the sort of few survivors, mostly British and American citizens, plus this one German, must kind of try to work together to survive, to try to find some rescue, try to find some place, you know, that they can, you know, but they're stuck in the middle of the ocean. And there's definitely a metaphorical component to this movie in that, you know, that German character, that one German character, the Nazi, is kind of undermining and sabotaging the boat. And ultimately, the message is that the, you know, the Allies, the British and American characters who come from all these different walks of life, they have to band together to defeat him. And essentially, the Allies need to band together to win World War II. That's kind of the subtext of the movie.
The first order of business is department heads. Sparks?
Yes, Mr. Redmass.
Call me Ritt. We're all in the same boat.
Yes, sir. Ritt.
Sparks, you're in charge of navigation.
Aye, aye, sir.
George?
Call me Joe.
Your name Joe?
Yes, sir.
Well, Joe it is. You are head of the commissary.
Yes, sir.
Connie, will you keep the ship's log, please?
Righto, Ritto, providing I control the copyright and all publication rights, including the Scandinavian.
Yes. Miss McKenzie, you are in charge of sick bay.
Don't look now, but I think we have a skipper.
Who elected Mr. Rittenhouse?
Mr. Rittenhouse?
Ritt to you.
You think he's capable?
Sure, until the sail goes up.
We never should have let him stay on board. He'll eat our food, drink our water, and double-cross his first chance he gets.
What are you afraid of? He's one against seven.
It was eight yesterday, or have you forgotten?
This was a pretty unusual and unique movie in its day. Now I almost think we could have done a whole lifeboat-themed episode of Film Spotting SVU. I mean, just in the last couple years, there was Life of Pi. There was All Is Lost. So it's something that happens more these days, but it was very unique when Hitchcock did it. And I think one of the dangers of these kinds of movies, which I don't think we've talked about, meaning claustrophobic movies, is that they can feel a little stagey because you are confined to one space. So the challenge there is always to make it feel like a movie and not feel like a play that you just happened to shoot. And the way you do that is you have a great director who knows how to use the camera. And there's very few people who ever knew how to do it better than Alfred Hitchcock. And in Lifeboat, just incredible use of camera, placement of camera, the editing, and also the blocking, which is very important, something you don't talk a lot about, but just the placement of the characters in the frame and how that kind of tells their story and explains their relationships is all very important. And then the thing that makes this one so fun, and also things like Life of Pi or All Is Lost or anything like that, is the fact that it's both claustrophobic and so expansive. You know, like the you're in the middle of the ocean and you know there's space as far as the eye can see, but you're trapped on this one little part of it, and you just feel so small and hopeless. And again, being so confined with these 7, 8, 9 people that are on this boat, it's just an extra cruel twist on the formula that works so well. So that is Lifeboat, and you can rent it on iTunes or you can buy it on Amazon.
Yeah, me and a couple.
Excuse me. The police are on their way.
She's lying.
You're full of
It's not an intercom. It's a PA system.
I know. I'm just scaring her.
I suggest you leave before they get here.
It was another close race for the Listener's Choice review on our last episode. Devil in a Blue Dress was the third place option. It got 24% of the vote. The original Night of the Living Dead from 1968 got 36% of the vote, but winning out was Panic Room with 39% of the vote. So it was a close one, but Panic Room was the winner. The film stars Jodie Foster as Meg Altman, a recently divorced mother of a young girl named Sarah, who's played by, as we mentioned before, a very young, pre-Twilight, and borderline unrecognizable Kristen Stewart. They buy a new house on the Upper West Side of Manhattan that seems too good to be true. There's four floors. It's got an elevator. And in the master bedroom, most importantly, it has what is called a panic room that is virtually impregnable and would keep the owner safe in case of home invasion. And this turns out to be a very useful feature because on the very first night Meg and Sarah are staying in the house, it's broken into by three men played by Forrest Whitaker, Jared Leto, and a ski-masked Dwight Yoakam. And they're looking for something that the previous owner left behind. After that, it's a battle of wills and brains as the mother and daughter, who can't leave the panic room or call for help, try to get the bad guys to leave and to survive. Panic Room was directed by David Fincher. It was his 2002 film and his follow-up to his very successful and now very iconic 1999 movie Fight Club. And as I think we mentioned on our last episode when we discussed it as a listener's choice option, we both saw Panic Room when it debuted and we enjoyed it well enough. But maybe we were a little underwhelmed, possibly because in the wake of Fight Club, our expectations for it were so high. So my question to you, Allison, is with the benefit of now over a decade of distance and the addition of other Fincher films like Zodiac, Curious Case of Benjamin Button, and The Social Network, how do you feel about Panic Room now? Were you right about it in 2002, or did you underrate it, or I don't know, did you overrate it?
I feel like I underrated it, actually. Coming back to it now, I mean, certainly in the very, just the filmmaking, the aspects of the filmmaking and the way the camera moves around this space, this kind of really insanely luxurious Manhattan building, the kind of building that I can't imagine how much it would cost then, how much it would cost now.
Yes. But as we record this in my tiny office with books literally almost stacked to the ceilings because there's
the
no
idea
space.
Of the amount of space that they have.
Yeah.
But the way that the camera, and you know, this is that Fincher used computer generated imagery to kind of have these impossible shots, including the kind of long take in which
the showcase shot
in which starts with kind of zooming out from Jodie Foster in bed. They've just moved
all the
in,
way at the top,
all the way out, and then kind of fall, like goes down through the
goes
house,
through the banister, down the stairs,
and then
through
as,
a keyhole at one point.
And then as the robbers are coming up,
right,
and they kind of try the door, and then they go around the back, and it tracks them. It's this crazy shot that not uses the real space and these impossible movements,
right,
of doing these things and combines them so fluidly. It is incredibly impressive. And I think, you know, that's the showiest shot. But like the ways in which the camera tracks characters through the house, it, you know, there's obviously a lot of surveillance plays a big role in this because when Jodie Foster is in the panic room, she has cameras that show her different parts of the house, which mm-hmm. is how she notices people are there.
Right.
But that the camera itself also kind of almost has this, it stalks them at certain points, especially when they first move in, that gives this really interesting sense of vulnerability and uncertainty to these characters in this cavernous space. And that aspect of it, I was really impressed by, and I don't think I had really registered when I first saw it, like that it really is just impressively shot. And, you know, I know that Fincher like was so kind of obsessive about this that it caused him some problems in production, just in terms of he had first brought on Darius Kanji, his a cinematographer he'd worked with before, ended up firing him, bringing in someone else. It was a very meticulous production that faced some difficulties, but it really, I was really impressed by that aspect of it coming back. How about you?
I liked it too, and I liked it more than I did in 2002 as well. I mean, it's just a thriller, but it's, as you said, it's just so well shot, well constructed, and I think well written too. I think we do have to give some credit to David Koepp, the screenwriter, just for being a thriller that's, you know, it's smart. You know, it doesn't cheat too much, you know, and it comes up with lots of clever twists that don't feel out of place or very screenwriterly. Or, you know, I found this quote from Roger Ebert's review of the film that I thought was really right on the money, so I'm just gonna read it. He says, "Once we sense Panic Room isn't going to cheat, it gathers intention because the characters are operating out of their own resources, and that makes them the players, not the pawns in this game," which is so true. I mean, how often do you see a thriller or a horror movie, a slasher movie or whatever, where you just go, this character is a moron and they're only doing this because the movie needs them to do it. The script demands them to make this dumb decision, to make this stupid choice that no person in this situation would do. And in Panic Room, it's not that every character is smart. In fact, Jared Leto's character is sort of an idiot. Like, that's part of his character. He's not very bright. But the things he does are totally logical to his character. He never does anything that doesn't make sense. Or he doesn't get instantly smarter. You know what I mean? That's almost another trick that a thriller might do, is suddenly a character who's not too bright suddenly gets a great idea. That doesn't happen. And I think that all the twists and turns are so perfectly structured and put together. And the movie is just, it's a really suspenseful ride. And as you said, it's also very stylish. I mean, just what we were talking about with Lifeboat in terms of making an uncinematic subject cinematic, I think that's what you see Fincher doing there, is injecting a little bit of visual excitement into this thing that is literally just set in this four-story apartment building or, you know, brownstone. And that could start to look a little flat and a little boring if it didn't have a guy like Fincher who's putting in all of these very fancy shots, which also serve the purpose of laying out the space, explaining exactly where everything is, because it's not that easy to understand. It's like, you know, that some things are on the third floor, some things are on the top floor, some things are on the first floor. And that shot that, you know, links everything together really shows you, here's where this is, here's where this is, here's how everything connects together. And yeah, there's a little bit of, you know, flashiness, the going into the keyhole and all that sort of thing. But after that shot's over, you really understand where all the characters are in relation to one another, which is very important because this movie is all about those connections and how the space is used and how when they're very close, she can't get out. But maybe when they go down the stairs, she might be able to sneak out to get this thing she needs or that thing she needs. So, yeah, I mean, I don't think it's up to the level of a Fight Club or a Zodiac, but it's clearly the work of a very, very good director.
Yeah, and it also, it has an interesting dynamic in terms of its main character, you know, that you have Jodie Foster's character who is a little hurt by this divorce. She was married to a man who has left her for another woman. She's a little humiliated, and she buys this house in part to kind of, because he has to pay for it, right?
To stick it to him.
Stick it to him. So she buys this outrageously, like, lavish house.
Right.
That's way too big for them, which is part of the kind of the idea, is that, yes, like, they're dwarfed by this huge space, mm-hmm, right? But that also, that she is put in a position to kind of have to defend her daughter by herself, right? And that's part of this, the underlying dynamic, is that it's the two of them by themselves. And her daughter has diabetes as well, which is this something that becomes more pressing.
Ticking clock. That
goes along. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, she doesn't really have anyone to summon. It's just the two of them in the house. And I think that the film does actually a very kind of clever job of what's a somewhat familiar dynamic in action movies and thrillers, which is your family is threatened. You know, how do you act? And to have a very, you know, consciously female slant to that. When I think of things like Taken or like a lot of just, you know, where you have a male lead and his family's threatened.
The daughter's,
he's going to go, you know, he's going to take them back.
Kidnapped.
And it's kind of about this like very like manly, like I'm going to take care of my family. You know, when Jodie Foster's character, when her, when she gets separated from Kristen Stewart's character, she's like destroyed, right? Like she just can't really think. She's not really thinking through from a strategic standpoint. She just, all she wants to do is get medicine to her daughter.
Right.
And I feel like the film handled that very dramatically and very well. This is not, you know, someone like who's inherently a badass just
right,
waiting to come out. She's a mom.
It's not Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah. And that, like,
unfortunately.
Can't be in every movie.
Yes.
You have to settle for Jodie Foster. But that it does a really nice job of having this, you know, Upper West Side, Upper East Side mom, or, you know, Greenwich, Connecticut mom, or whatever she's supposed to be. And to put her in this incredibly stressful situation and have her show strength in a way that's very believable for her character's background.
Right.
And I like that a lot.
And she doesn't do anything that doesn't seem unbelievable. You know, it's not, like you said, it's not like she
suddenly displays this mixed martial arts background that she's been hiding the whole time.
Right, like, yeah, exactly, and takes them all down with judo kicks or whatever. Or, you know, even at the end, there's a moment where, and I don't think this is a spoiler, you know, like, they're into the panic room, they're out of the panic room, and there's one point where she's sort of, like, kind of setting up a trap a little bit for them near the end of the movie. And she's kind of going through the house and, like, breaking some glass and stuff. And you almost chuckle because there's that moment. It almost feels like Home Alone.
Yeah.
You know, but again, but it never gets into that crazy territory. And it really you admire the fact that this movie could get so silly, you know. And there are there's so many examples of movies like this that do get silly. And even, like, something like, you know, the movie that Jodie Foster made after this that I think was kind of an attempt to sort of, like, recreate it, Flight Plan, which was where she's, like, her daughter is kidnapped on an airplane and then she's running around. It's kind of like, you know, it's the same claustrophobic premise, but it's on an airplane and she has to find her daughter and no one believes her and yada yada yada. You know, that movie is just ridiculous. But this movie is not, you know. Yeah. There is an element of it that feels very real, you know, that makes it more terrifying, you know, and that makes it more entertaining too, because, like that quote from Ebert says, that just raises the stakes, you know, when you feel like the characters are players, not pawns, but also you understand the rules of the game, and the game doesn't change, really. It's not like at one point in the middle, suddenly she's a kung fu master, or suddenly in the middle, the killers, you know, do something incredibly stupid, you know. It's very incremental, A to B, B to C, C to D, and every step of the way, you're invested, and you're just getting perpetually more invested. And the other thing I noticed about it this time is sort of, because it's not a long movie, I think it's like an hour and 40 minutes, and most of it is sort of the showdown between the two sides, how economical the beginning of the movie is in terms of laying out these characters and laying out the scenario. You know, like, the first scene is them seeing this house, the real estate agent is showing it to them, and he's showing them the house, he's also showing us the house. Again, laying everything out, but also he's dropping hints that we don't realize until the movie's over, or, you know, you've seen it a second time, you go back, you realize they're setting up a lot of the stuff that comes into play later in the movie, including my favorite one, which if I noticed it 12 years ago, I didn't remember it, the whole thing about the door of the panic room, which has, like, laser sensors, which is one of the dumb things about the movie. The lasers are visible. There's, like, visible bright green lasers that essentially, like, supposedly, like, when the plane of the lasers is broken, it's like an elevator. The panic room door opens back up so it won't close on something, which has a wonderful, almost really darkly hilarious payoff later in the movie.
Yeah, it's definitely a very, it's a setup that's so nicely done. It's so nicely handled. All that exposition, which is delivered in the form that the characters would actually need.
Mm-hmm.
It is very cleverly done. What did you think of Jared Leto in this? He's got kind of
the braids,
amazing hair. Yes.
Yes.
And he's just a total jerk.
He is. He is. He's very good, though, in the movie. I mean, it's kind of funny because I watched this last night with my wife, who's, you know, huge, my so-called life fan. And I'm like, it's Jordan Catalano. And she's like, oh, look at how terrible he looks. But it was funny because he's kind of a dopey in the movie, which I was like, oh, he's still playing. Maybe this is where Jordan Catalano wound up, because, you know, that's sort of like the you know, he's good at playing those kind of dim characters. But the guy that I really thought was great was Dwight Yoakam, actually, who was my favorite this time. I think Jodie Foster as Raoul. Yeah. Jodie Foster, I think, is fantastic. And she has a couple of fantastic scenes, including one where she has to talk to the cops, which is absolutely incredible. But really, the one that really surprised me was Dwight Yoakam. I had forgot he was totally in it, and he plays most of the movie in a ski mask. So if you don't remember he's in it and you're not paying too much attention to the opening credits, you forget who he is, and the whole movie you're going, who is this guy? And then at the end, you realize it's Dwight Yoakam. And I just thought he was so menacing and terrifying, and it's freaking Dwight Yoakam, but he has this air of kind of ruthlessness that, you know, a lot of these kind of movies have, you know, that character who's the more violent, the more vicious one. And they
the one who gets everyone into trouble in the end.
Yes.
Yeah.
Who's too violent, who's too psychopathic, you know, that doesn't want to stick to the plan. And that character can verge into kind of craziness and kind of silliness again. And he doesn't get there. He just he's terrifying without seeming like a sneering, you know, snidely whiplash villain.
Yeah. And I think it also, they're the film does something interesting in not being your classic, or not setting up a very easy divide between haves and have-nots in this. You know, in a lot of ways, the setup would seem to imply rich people and like getting barricading themselves in this, you know,
right,
luxury building, and then these people trying to break in.
The 99%,
yeah,
coming
exactly
to reap
but
their
revenge. It's much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
Particular, like who Jared Leto's character turns out to be. But there is still a bit of this, you know, one character trying to kind of excuse himself to be like, you know, for my child, I wanted this for my child.
Right.
And yet, of course, the whole argument the movie makes is that you're not really doing your child any favors by putting them in this kind of like high target building.
Right.
But I liked that. The movie kind of lets all of this stuff bleed in, but doesn't I need to spell it out too much, you know, that it's kind of, these are elements there, but in the same way that Kristen Stewart's diabetes is included in there, it's not in the very beginning, you know, Jodie Foster does not say, you know, be careful about your diabetes.
Right.
Like it's allowed
it's
to kind
of... It's a shot of a refrigerator
with
where
insulin.
With insulin,
yeah,
in it. Right, exactly.
Yeah. That it does... The movie does actually trust you,
yeah,
for like a kind of commercial thriller.
Right.
That puts trust in the audience in a way that's really nice.
Yeah, and that what you mentioned about the, you know, the parental aspect of one of the, you know, one of the burglars has a sort of a child that's a motivation, you know, wanting to care for this child. So you have that dynamic between two parents, I think, which is also very interesting, that like the lengths someone will go to for good or for bad to provide for their child, to protect their child, I think is definitely a big part of the movie. And, but you know, not harped on too strongly, but you can certainly see it in there.
Yeah.
And it's just another thing that just makes it a little bit more satisfying.
Yeah. It's definitely like a very, which is why I think one of the reasons that why when I first saw it, it didn't resonate with me as much, is that it's a very, it's a mainstream thriller,
yeah,
but it's just so well made.
It's very well made.
And there's something to that that you can appreciate.
Right.
Before we cut this off,
yeah,
the original casting
was Nicole Kidman, right?
And Hayden Panettiere as the child.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, they recast the child too.
Uh-huh.
I did that.
She dropped out, and then Kristen Stewart brought in. Yeah.
Oh,
what
wow
would you think? Wouldn't that seem like a totally different dynamic and movie?
Wow. I didn't know about the Hayden Panettiere part. That's so funny, because I was thinking, you know, Kristen Stewart is such a great, you know, she really does look in this movie like she's Jodie Foster's daughter. And I was wondering, because I did know that Nicole Kidman, she was hired. I think she hurt, like she was injured.
Her knee, yeah.
And so she couldn't, it's a very physical part. She couldn't do it. So they replaced her with Jodie Foster at the last minute. And I was wondering, like, was Kristen Stewart supposed to be Nicole Kidman's daughter? That doesn't really, so that does make a little sense. I'm trying to envision it. I mean, I don't know. Has Nicole Kidman ever done a thriller like this?
I don't know, but it does seem like, in some ways, a more traditional kind of casting of this wealthy divorce. You know what I mean?
Yeah, she maybe fits the type of the character a little better than Jodie Foster does.
A little better, but it seems like it would also... I just can't imagine her kind of being as tough as Jodie Foster ends up being in this.
Right. It would have been... I'm not opposed to it, though. It'd be interesting to see. It's like a, you know, one of those, you know, eternal what ifs. Like, what if this movie had been with Nicole Kidman? Would it have been different? Would it have been better? Would it have been worse? We won't never know, but it's interesting to think about. I don't know. I could see her in it.
It would
maybe
seem like a very different movie, though.
Oh, for sure.
In a way, yeah. Apparently, that's her voice on the phone when
she answers the phone.
Yes.
She's the
new
mistress,
girlfriend.
The new girlfriend, or whatever. Interesting. That's funny. I did not notice that either.
Yeah.
All right. So that's Panic Room. It's streaming now.
Holds up.
Except for a few
weird 90s references. Poe, I think that was the big one.
Yeah. Some of the CGI also. I mean,
Titanic.
There's a Titanic joke. Some of the CGI in that fancy smancy shot does not look as good as like, and as seamless as like the stuff in like Zodiac, for
right
example, where it's become almost photoreal. I mean, there's a couple of moments in there that do look kind of CG. Yeah, but still a good movie.
Still pretty
impressive. Definitely better than we remembered. So that's Panic Room, and it is streaming on Netflix.
Well, that brings us to our Behind the Eight Ball section, in which we offer you three films or TV shows that are new to streaming, two listener recommendations, and one from our Netflix My Lists. Matt, you're going first. Are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Three new picks.
Okay. First up is the directorial debut of Andrew Niccol, Gattaca, a very prescient science fiction film about a future where people's lives are determined entirely by their genetics. If your genes say that you should live to be 100, you're made in the shade, you're going to have a great job and a great life. If they say you have a high risk of heart attack, you're in big trouble. Ethan Hawke stars as this guy who's like one of the last naturally conceived people on Earth, and he concocts this very elaborate scheme to assume the identity of a genetically superior man, played by definitely the most genetically superior man on Earth, Jude Law, although probably his genetics would have said something about that receding hairline, I think. I don't know. Maybe this movie wasn't as good as I thought. But anyway, from there, actually, it becomes kind of a cat-and-mouse thriller. There's a murder. Hawke's character is innocent, but he might get exposed, his little scheme as a result. So he's trying to stay ahead of the police as they're investigating. And it's an interesting thriller, but, you know, there's still plenty of ideas in it which are really interesting to kind of think about. This idea of identity, what makes us a person, you know, do our genes really, you know, nature versus nurture, do our genes really make us who we are? The movie was not a huge hit, but it's definitely become more of a cult film. I'd actually never seen it. I just watched it for the first time this week. I liked it. I thought it was a very interesting movie, and I think it's only going to get more timely and more popular. Anytime there's a news story about designer babies, we get a little bit closer to Gattaca. So that's Gattaca streaming on Netflix. My next pick is available for rent on iTunes and Amazon. One of my favorite movies from last year, Inside Llewyn Davis from the Coen brothers. It was sold as sort of a look at the 1960s folk rock scene in Greenwich Village, New York City. But that's really just the setting for this character study about this one particular folk singer, Llewyn Davis, played by Oscar Isaac, who really deserved an Oscar nomination last year. It was very upset, as much as I ever get upset about the Oscars, that he didn't get it. He's lost his partner in this folk duo, and he's now trying to make it as a solo artist with very little success. I saw this movie twice. I loved it. I had amazing, you know, discussions and conversations about it. It's about a lot of things, but one of the ones that resonated really strongly with me is just the idea that it's made by Joel and Ethan Coen, these brothers, these partners. They do everything together. They write, direct, produce, they edit everything together. And so to me, the movie was almost this, like, what if one of them had died? Like, what would the other's career have looked like? And kind of like a nightmare scenario of that. And so many other things, but that was just one thing that I found in there. So that's Inside Llewyn Davis. If you haven't seen it yet, strongly recommended. It's available on iTunes and Amazon. And finally, my last recommendation is I'm going to recommend actually a new streaming site that I don't think we've mentioned yet on the show, but if we have, what the heck, I'm going to do it again. It's called Watch TCM. It's from Turner Classic Movies. This is their new app and streaming site at tcm.com, where you can get the app on your phone or your tablet. And basically, you can watch what's actually playing live at that moment on the network if you're a subscriber to TCM. If you have cable and you get TCM, most, I think, cable providers are participate in this. So you can watch what's on the network, or a lot of the movies that have just played recently on the network are available to watch on demand. So it's hard to like recommend specific titles for us because they're really only up there for about a week or so before they vanish. And, you know, by the time you listen to this, they may already be gone. But just looking at the selection right now, as we're recording this on March 23rd, some of the titles that are on there include The Adventures of Robin Hood, The Gold Rush, The Mouse That Roared, Ride the High Country, and Swing Time, and quite a few more. So if you have cable and you have TCM on your cable, strongly recommend you take advantage of this service that they're offering. I've been using it a lot lately. So let's watch TCM. And the website is tcm.com, and then you just click on the Watch TCM thing, or you can get it on your tablet or your phone, the app for it.
All right, two listener recommendations.
All right, both of my recommendations come from international listeners, which is fabulous. I know that the world of streaming, we're generally talking about American services. Not all these are available around the world. So I appreciate that people are listening and giving us some international recommendations, and I try to sort of, where applicable, see what's available here, you know, that. So I try to find some things that you can watch if you are in the U.S. But our first recommendation is from Jeff in Oxford, U.K. He wants to recommend the work of Lake Bell, who is fantastic, he says, a wunderkind, the U.S. equivalent of talented Canadian filmmaker Sarah Polley. I first caught up with Bell in the television show Surface, a cheesy but fun sci-fi series, and knew there was something special about her right then, and intelligence better than the role that was written for her. In a World, which I think I remember you guys recommended recently, really shows how smart and multi-talented she really is. Hopefully this is just the beginning of her career. So Surface, the TV show, if you want to check that out, is available on Amazon Instant Video. Or Jeff says Love Film in the UK. I think that might be Amazon.
That is Amazon.
Surface,
yeah.
In the UK is called Love Film, so that's available there. And In a World is currently available to rent or buy on a variety of services. My next recommendation comes from, I think it's Kyan, K-Y-A-N, in New Zealand. New Zealand listener says, my recommendation this week is a completely different type of streaming service that I think you guys haven't talked about. As you may know, New Zealand has a publicly funded TV and film, which is responsible for just about all of our local product. Socialist overlords sometimes have their plus sides. Because of this, much of our publicly funded programs, especially older ones, are available for streaming on the site NZ On Screen. I only discovered this a few days ago when researching a project, and I came across a whole treasure trove of old short films, TV programs, and features from New Zealand that are pretty much impossible to find anywhere else. And he recommends several things, including this TV film by Peter Wells called A Death in the Family from 1986, the story of the gay community in New Zealand caring for one of their friends who was one of the first New Zealanders to die on screen. And Kyan notes, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing your name, that NZ On Screen is actually available everywhere around the world. It's free to view without ads, and so I actually checked it, and it is. I was able to find the link that he sent us, and it's nzonscreen.com, so you could browse it and check the whole thing out. So that's a great recommendation. Thank you. All the way from New Zealand.
Very cool.
I love it.
I wish we'd known about that when we did the New Zealand episode.
Yes, we did a whole episode that might have benefited from that, but it's never too late to learn.
Yeah. All right, well, one from your My List.
You gave me number 33, which this time is Vernon, Florida, the second film from documentarian Errol Morris, that his follow-up to Gates of Heaven. It is about the strange residents of a town in Florida named Vernon. And I've never seen it, even though I'm a big Errol Morris fan. You know, Thin Blue Line, Gates of Heaven, Mr. Death, Tablet. I'm looking forward to his new movie. I think comes out next month, The Unknown Known, about Donald Rumsfeld.
Yes.
I haven't seen Vernon, Florida, so it's on my list. And hopefully at some point I will get around to it. Allison, are you ready for your countdown?
No. Okay, yes.
Okay, why don't you start with three new titles?
All right. First up is Mud, which is new to Netflix and to Amazon Prime, so you can watch it on either site. If we are in the depths of the McConaissance now, this now Oscar winner Matthew McConaughey is one of the stars of this movie, which is written and directed by Jeff Nichols of the great film Take Shelter. And I think we've mentioned this film before when it was available on demand. It's, I think, a really good one that's a little underrated, but it's about a pair of 14-year-old boys, one of which is the main character, who are in Arkansas and living in this on a riverboat, one of them, in a way of life that is kind of going away. And it's both a film about that, it's a coming-of-age film, and it's one in which they find the title character, whose name is Mud, played by Matthew McConaughey, out in a island, and he turns out to be running away from things and to have a kind of romantic story that the boys are lured in by, but that turns out to be a little more complicated than how he tells it. Really, really nice film and a really strong performance from the two kids who are the lead actors. It's really nice. That's Mud, available on Netflix and Amazon. New to Hulu, Frankenhooker, the 1990 film directed by Frank Henlotter, starring James Lawrence as a med school student or med school dropout and aspiring, you know, mad scientist type who tries to bring his fiance, played by Patty Mullen, back after a freak lawnmower accident. You know, they happen. He collects body parts from the local red light district. However, when he puts her back together, it's not quite the same. She seems to have picked up a predilection for street walking and is a little dangerous to the John she picks up.
It's a powerful true story. Yeah. Don't diminish it.
Bill Murray said of this film, if you see one movie this year, it should be Frankenhooker. And certainly with a title like Frankenhooker, how can you really pass it up? That's on Hulu. And now new to Netflix is 20 Feet from Stardom. This is the winner of this year's Oscar for Best Documentary. The film is directed by Morgan Neville and focuses on backup singers, including Darlene Love, Judith Hill, Mary Clayton, and is all about these women who are the voices who've contributed to some of these great tracks, including some great rock and roll tracks. And it's, you know, actually all of the Oscar nominated docs are available on Netflix now. The Square, Dirty Wars, Cutie and the Boxer, and The Act of Killing are all up there. 20 Feet from Stardom is definitely the big crowd pleaser of the group and maybe the most, you know, traditional of the docs, and it was a really good year for docs, but that's not necessarily a slight. And it ended up not just winning the Oscar, but giving an opportunity for Darlene Love to sing when she accepted it, and that was pretty great. So that is available now on Netflix.
Okay, how about two listener recommendations?
All right. First recommendation is from Christopher, who sent a lot of great recommendations to us, including some for some Romero films. Unfortunately, Night of the Living Dead did not win, so they didn't quite apply. But he does recommend Blow Up, which is available for rent on Google Play, YouTube, and Vudu. He says that Michelangelo Antonioni's examination of disconnection in swinging 60s London is a good introduction to his work. David Hemmings plays the unnamed central character, who is a photographer who comes to believe that he has inadvertently photographed a murder. Again, the film here deals largely with a sense of identity and of the very nature of reality, and especially the need for connection with others that allows us to share a sense of reality. But the disconnection between characters here questions any sense of reality that we might have. And Blow Up, certainly a great film. The other recommendation is from Gil, who writes, I recently watched Deceptive Practice, The Mysteries and Mentors of Ricky Jay on Netflix. For those who haven't heard of him, Ricky Jay is a master illusionist who is not only highly skilled in magic and sleight of hand, but who also holds several records for his ability to throw playing cards great distances with such force that he can pierce the skin of a watermelon. Besides being a talented magician, Jay is also an actor who has appeared in numerous films and television shows, including movies by P.T. Anderson and David Mamet. On top of all this, Jay has extensive knowledge of con artistry and flimflam, which means that his personal life has always been somewhat shrouded in mystery until now. Deceptive Practice looks at Jay's life, from his childhood love of magic and his training by some of the great vaudeville illusionists to the present day, where he tours his magic shows, works in the movies, and has taught an apprentice of his own. If you have any interest in the world of cons and cards, then this movie is a must. As someone who loves magic and has always been intrigued by the mysterious character that is Ricky Jay, this movie is insightful and a great watch. And that is a movie that I have added to my list because, you know, throwing card skill alone.
You love Gambit. You love any person that can become a real life from the X-Men.
Exactly.
Cards. You didn't know. The look you gave me said, I have no idea what you're talking about. I forgot you were not a comic book nerd for a second. I'm sorry. He throws cards.
I know.
I've seen that movie, and it's very interesting and very entertaining. If you're a fan of magic, if you're a fan of Ricky Jay, totally worth checking out. How about one film chosen blindly by random from your
my list? You gave me number 71, which is Kevin. This is a 2011 doc directed by Jay Duplass of the Duplass Brothers. Here's a description. This documentary explores the mysterious disappearance of singer-songwriter Kevin Gant, a key member of Austin's cultural scene in the early 1990s. It sounds a little kind of a small film and kind of a little specific to the Austin scene, but I'm always interested in what the Duplass brothers are up to.
I've seen it actually. I think it's like only like 45 minutes or maybe even shorter than that. It's like a short, it's not quite a feature, but it's an interesting documentary. I actually did a Q&A for it at a small film festival in New York with Jay Duplass over Skype. I think he couldn't make it into town.
He's a busy guy. Both of those guys are very busy these
days. But yeah, it's a nice little film. It's worth checking out.
Well, it's on my list, though it's kind of far down there.
All right. It's time to get to our new batch of listeners' choice options. And we are so excited about the new film from Jim Jarmusch called Only Lovers Left Alive. I think it's about vampires. I think Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston are in it as vampires.
As really cool looking vampires.
Oh, my God.
Rock star kind of New York urban looking vampires.
The film premiered at Cannes last year, I believe. It got great reviews. I've heard nothing but great things about it. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. And we thought, since you know, we're going to be looking forward to that and talking about Jim Jarmusch, and he's got a lot of movies available on streaming, let's do a Jim Jarmusch movie on our next episode. We've got three Jarmuschy options. Allison, I think you have the first one. What is it?
Yes, it is Permanent Vacation. It's available on Hulu Plus. It's a 1980 film, which is his first film after he dropped out of film school. And not easy to find a telling description of it. It stars Chris Parker as a character who, from all accounts, wanders around New York meeting interesting people. So interesting, quirky characters. So basically setting a template for a lot of what Jim Jarmusch would go on to do.
And I think that would be interesting because I haven't seen that one. And it does sound like a lot of his movies. So I think it is always interesting for, to go back.
See how someone starts.
See how they start, especially if that first film is kind of indicative, as it sometimes is, of like the path they're going to take in their career.
Yeah. And also, always interesting to see like kind of gritty 1980s New York, early 1980s. It's a very different time in the city than present day.
Yep.
So that's Permanent Vacation. That's the first one.
Okay.
The second.
Our second one is also available on Hulu Plus. I think the Criterion Collection has quite a few Jarmusch films, and that's what's mostly streaming online. And it's called Down by Law. One of his, I don't know about financially successful, it's certainly one of his most famous movies and really one of his breakthrough films from earlier in his career. I'll read the plot description here from Criterion. It says, director Jim Jarmusch followed his brilliant breakout film Stranger Than Paradise with another equally beloved portrait of loners and misfits in the American landscape when fate brings together three hapless men, an unemployed disc jockey, Tom Waits, a small-time pimp, John Lurie, and a strong-willed Italian tourist, Roberto Benigni, in a Louisiana prison. A singular adventure ensues, which was described by Jim Jarmusch as a neo-beat noir comedy. It's in black and white. I have seen that one, and it's a great film, and would not mind one bit revisiting it and talking about it, because it's been a while. I saw it in grad school. I've seen it once since then, but it's been quite a few years, and would definitely love to talk about that one. And you know what? Roberto Benigni's pretty damn good in that movie, too, so that would be fun to talk about as well.
All right, and our third pick is available on Netflix. It is Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai, Jarmusch's 1999 film starring Forest Whitaker.
Panic Rooms, Forest Whitaker.
Yes, Panic Rooms, Forest Whitaker.
Could be a trend on the show, potentially.
He plays a kind of eccentric mafia hitman who follows the code of the samurai. And it's a film that some people have compared to Le Samurai, but also it definitely undermines some of the basic ideas about like what the mafia is like in movies and about what hitmen are like, and has a very strong Forest Whitaker performance. And this is a movie I haven't seen, I think, since it basically had come out. And I remember being very bemused by it when it first came out. So I'd be interested to take another look at it since it's definitely got a cult following.
Oh, for sure.
Now, and probably
one of his most seen films at this point. And I actually have never seen it. Somehow.
Oh,
I'm kind of surprised. It's one of those movies that I can't even explain how I've somehow missed it all these years, because it is a cult film and I like Jarmusch.
And this was his bigger...
movies, yeah. All right, so which Jim Jarmusch film should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? Send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com. Or enter in the poll on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, March 31st at noon. After that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, twitter.com/filmspottingsvu. And you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on our next episode on or around Tuesday, April 8th.
FilmSpottingSVU.com is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Film Spotting SVU Remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the review that you pick. And in the meantime, you can follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore and at Matt Singer. And you can follow the show at Film Spotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share more streaming suggestions from you, the SVU listeners. For Film Spotting SVU, I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I'm Matt Singer. Thanks for listening. Dun, dun, dun.